We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Welcome to the Solid Verbal.
The Solid Verbal.
Come after me! I'm a man! I'm 40!
I've heard so many players say, well, I want to be happy. You want to be happy for a day? Eat a steak.
It's that woo woo!
And now, Dan and Ty.
Welcome back to the Solid Verbal, boys and girls. My name is Ty Hildebrandt. Joining me as always over there in beautiful and sunny, in almost springy New York City, Dan Rubenstein. Sir, how are you?
I'm pretty good, Ty. I'm pretty good. I considered stopping at any number of places on my walk home from the office for a little snack, but I was just in LA for a very short time for a podcast conference.
Okay.
And ate a lot of food. So my discipline to stay the course was actually pretty admirable, unlike Mel Tucker.
Mel Tucker. Ooh,
we can get into that.
We're going to get into the Mel Tucker news here. Momentarily, today's a Q&A show, or at least part one of a Q&A show. So it works in typical fashion here on the Solid Verbal. We like to do more of the Q&A style show in the off season because there isn't as much news to talk about. Mel Tucker ain't walking out that door every week after all. So
we gotta
fill the time with useful college football intel and knowledge and questions from the Verballerhood at large. So what you did is went out on Twitter, you went out on all of our social channels. We got other email questions that came in to solidverbal@gmail.com, compiled those in a big old Google Doc, and we're going to read through a bunch of football questions here in just a little bit. The other tidbit that I'll throw out there, and I started advertising this a little bit on Twitter earlier today, at solidverbal if you don't already follow us, but as we said, Dan and I are in the very early stages now of planning out what our live show menu is going to look like for the month of August, when we typically do fantasy things, and maybe we'll throw other things in there, who knows. But we put together a survey, which I linked up on our Twitter sphere. I'm going to link it up on our website. If you go to solidverbal.com/live, you can get to our survey and just let us know if you're going to be around in August, if any of these cities or locations appeal to you. You might want to come out and see us. That'll help us put together what our game plan is going to be come August. But it is something we're starting to think about, even though it's February. Obviously, it's better to do that earlier and get people in the know than later, kind of at the last second.
Yeah. If it were up to me, we would just be doing a tour of small towns just north of San Francisco and have a nice little summer wine tour.
You don't even like wine.
I don't even like wine, but I like that area, Ty.
Yeah.
I like trees. I like grapes. I like sunshine. There's a million places that I think we would have a terrific time doing a live show and could not be happier about doing that. All we really know is that somehow, some way, we are going to include the Navarro cheer team.
Of course.
Oh, my gosh. My people. All right, absolute people. Okay, sorry. boop, 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 boop.
You mentioned Mel Tucker at the top. Mel Tucker has reversed course. So Mel Tucker, head football coach, formerly head football coach at Colorado.
Right.
He initially turned down Michigan State. He reversed course. He has now accepted the job at Sparty. Do you like this move?
I think it'd be hard to form an opinion about Mel Tucker after one season going 5-7, inheriting a not amazing roster, but still your guys Stevie Montez and Laviska Shenault are quality players that, you know, Shenault was hurt, but didn't have the talent to really turn the defense around, excuse me, in year one, his specialty. So I don't know how any Michigan State fan, how anybody can think like, yes, home run, when they're just jury's out. Like we just have no idea because we have to have a bigger sample size from him. The headline here, as you know, we talk about it like 6 days after it happened because that's our recording schedule, is that he was only at Colorado for a year. And he got basically his salary doubled. His assistant pool was significantly increased, which is very, very important, by a Michigan State program, which makes a lot more money from the Big Ten and their TV deals, plural, than the Pac-12 does. And Colorado is not a program that has been in the money this past decade, 15 years. Things have improved. I think they've built new facilities. But certainly from a monetary standpoint, Colorado is not as big a program and doesn't have as big a wallet as Michigan State does by, you know, their circumstance. So I think the hire is fine. I think his background, his experience, both, you know, in the SEC and the NFL, I think people respond well to him as a coach. It appears he's been able to recruit in his short time in Boulder pretty well. So I imagine he will do a pretty good job, given his background both in the Midwest and South, attracting talent to Michigan State. It's a tough job to me. So I think it's fine / TBD.
Here is my overarching question about this, though. How good of a job is that Michigan State job? I know it's something we've discussed here on the show.
Right.
And I think we like Boulder, Colorado as a college football or just college destination.
That's a human destination to me. Yeah.
Human destination, sure. Yeah. It's a good place. It's in a conference that is certainly a little bit more wide open than the Big Ten East. I think that much is assumed, right? So how much of a better job? Obviously the money's better, but outside of the money, is it truly a better college football spot than in Boulder?
So what defines that to you? How, if you are going to list items, bullet points, say this is what makes a good job. To me, it's administrative support, money, proximity to recruits, maybe path to maximizing success based on division, based on conference. How strong is the school's, you know, quote, brand regionally, nationally, internationally, whatever. And for Michigan State, it's tricky. I think if it starts with administrative support, there's a lot of the word interim right now at Michigan State. It's not a strong time for the Michigan State brand, not the fault of regional recruits in the Midwest or coaches that Mel Tucker, not a fault of a lot of people who were in that Michigan State program during some up and down years under Mark D'Antonio, but it's rough. I don't think there's a lot of confidence in the board of trustees and the athletic director and the athletic department right now. So that to me is in flux, which is never great, because if you look at schools that generally succeed consistently, there seems to be a good backbone of continuity there, right?
Yeah.
You've had, Notre Dame has had the same AD forever. Oregon has had the same AD forever. These are the schools we're most familiar with. Penn State had to deal with a lot of flux, but things have calmed down some, right?
Yeah.
So looking at schools, especially in the Big Ten, Wisconsin has a lot of continuity. Michigan has had some changes. Ohio State has had some changes, but Gene Smith has been at Ohio State for a long time, and so there's experience there running things. Michigan State's different, and Michigan State has had a lot of success in the last decade. One could point out that Michigan State's absolute height, 2013 to 2015, like we've talked about before, came at a time that perhaps Michigan and Ohio State, their chief rivals in the division, were not operating at full capacity. But one could also point out that Penn State and Michigan today are not unbeatable. So it can be a very good job. This is a Rose Bowl job if the circumstances are correct, but a lot of good jobs are the same way, that you just need things to break correctly. So I think it's tough, but I think Michigan State has a much higher ability, a higher ceiling than a lot of teams in this country.
The downside for Michigan State, whenever somebody steps aside in February or just at a really weird juncture in the season, if you want to get a decent name, you sort of got to pay the piper.
Yeah, premium.
And that meant good news for Mel Tucker on that side of things. Otherwise, I'm ambivalent on this. It's good news for them that they're able to go out and get a guy in Mel Tucker who's been highly thought of for a while and someone who you would think could continue building that winning tradition, certainly on the defensive side of the ball where he's always been very good. That's all very good news. But like 5-7 first year, you're paying that guy $5.5 million. Seems like maybe they overbid on a guy that, they didn't have to overbid for.
Well, they had the cash. They have the cash to pay that much money to a coach. I mean, Scott Frost is making a ton of money, and at least I guess he accomplished more as a head coach than Mel Tucker did going in. Jeff Brohm, I don't know how. I mean, he had a huge win for Purdue over Ohio State and had the leverage with Louisville coming after him. But there are what look to be not crazy impressive coaches in the Big Ten making, at least right now to me, impressive money. The other interesting thing is this: people treated this as more dirt on the Pac-12 casket, and I'm sort of confused by that somewhat. I know the Pac-12 has lagged behind. I know their TV deal isn't good, but I've just never understood why people look at the Pac-12 as like, yeah, they're a Power 5 conference. They should be right in the neighborhood as of how much money the Big Ten and SEC are making, when Pac-12 football as a whole, as a full product, has never been as popular as conferences that have these enormous, enormous properties, when the Pac-12 has like 1.8 of them.
So does a move like this, and I promise we'll move on after this.
Yeah, maybe 2.6.
Does a move like this worry you then about, like, let's say the overall health of Power 5 football or college football as a whole, given that there is this gulf between different revenue models from conference to conference?
I guess. I think you need smarter people at athletic departments making better decisions as to who you hire. I mean, it can be weathered in the Big Ten and SEC if, you know, if Mississippi State hires Joe Moorhead and it doesn't work out after a couple of years, they don't hesitate to pay his buyout, to move on, to pay Mike Leach, whatever it is, $5 million. And that's certainly a very nice luxury to have. But in the Big 12, which has, you know, come under some troubling times, having to go back to 10 teams, the TV deal isn't where the Big 10 and the SEC are, and the Pac-12, and to, I guess, a lesser extent, the ACC, you got to make better decisions. It's not Larry Scott's fault that, you know, Oregon State and Gary Anderson didn't work out. I tweeted that out. It's not, you know, Larry Scott's fault that, you know, Kevin Sublin has been pretty bad in terms of a hire for Arizona thus far. And it wasn't as, you know, whatever it was, John Embry, Mike McIntyre, and the up and down of his career there. That's not on the conference. It's just these schools need to do a better job of finding perhaps up-and-comers, perhaps better deals at head coach, and figuring out how to get creative in terms of raising money. And it's certainly tougher, but I'm not sure I ever understood why everybody needs to just automatically be on an equal playing field. Okay. I don't understand that. I don't reckon that's what college football has ever been.
I don't reckon. All right. The other tidbit here that I think we should probably mention.
Yeah.
So the Big Ten pitched it. The ACC agreed. A one-time transfer.
Yeah. The NCAA is now looking into it as well.
Yeah. Without penalty. It's under consideration for the 2020/2021 school year. To provide some important context here, the only sports for which you must sit out a year if you transfer are college football, both men's and women's basketball, also baseball, also hockey.
Right.
If you add this rule, one-time transfer without penalty, my guess is we're going to see a lot of interesting takes out there as to whether or not this is good, it's bad, there are winners, there are losers.
They're already out there. The takes are out there.
Oh, the takes are
Mark Richt alongside his weird hot dog sandwich thing is out there.
So what do you think? I'll tell you where I stand here.
Please.
I think this is a really good thing.
Okay.
And I understand the counter argument here is that it perhaps devalues a commitment. And why commit if you can just leave? I'm sure we're going to see plenty of, you know, the kids these days style arguments against this. But the truth of the matter is, and we've been beating this drum for years on this show, programs, coaches have so much leverage over these kids.
Yeah.
You know, I don't mean to demean the value of a scholarship. Certainly that's something that holds a lot of value.
Sure.
But programs have so much damn leverage over these kids. And we saw it with Mel Tucker. Look, I mean, Mel Tucker, I'm sure, didn't do it with any malice in his heart, but Mel Tucker got a godfather offer to go to a different school. He got $5.5 million. And now the kids that signed to play under Mel Tucker, he's not going to be there.
Yeah.
This is not
the first time. We saw Todd Graham. We saw Willie Taggart.
Happens all the time.
Yeah.
Happens every single year. So I don't know if this truly balances out that situation, but I do think it gives kids a little bit more leeway here. I like the move. I really do.
Yeah, I think offering freedom is a good thing. And I know people are going to say, well, like, this is free agency for college football. It's my opinion that kids don't want to transfer. Kids want to be happy with where they end up. Kids want to be somewhere where they're perhaps dating somebody. Perhaps they like their classes, if academics are a part of their life in a major way. They like their coaches. They're committing to a school because, you know, potentially their coach is there and stays there. They're committing to a school because maybe they like the college town. Maybe they like the campus. Maybe they like the food. Maybe they like the facilities. They want to succeed in the place they commit to. And I can't imagine, like, people are freaking out because they think it's free agency. Like, well, if it doesn't work out here, they're just going to go over there. Okay. You want people to want to be where you are. I think that's an understanding. Whether it's in an office setting, whether it's in a family setting, you want people to want to be there. And if you have all sorts of people who are not happy with their role, who've been sitting for 2-3 years, or who get somewhere and be like, yeah, this was definitely a wrong decision. I'm trying to see this through, but I am unhappy. You want your locker room to be filled with happy people. That's why a team like Clemson has succeeded to the degree that they've succeeded, because people, coaches, players, support staff want to work for Dabo Swinney at Clemson. And so it actually puts a lot more pressure on people running programs and running athletic departments to build a culture that people want to be a part of. And you cannot hire D-holes, Ty. You can't hire D-holes as much. And that's a big win.
You know, I mean, so much of the problem with college football is the fact that it's college football, that it's not club football, that we've tied in the academics with the sport. I think that's the root of much of the evil that we see in college football. And somebody once told me that without exception, any player who plays at the D1 level, certainly the D1 Power 5 level, without exception, all of those kids think they're going to the NFL.
Of course.
Perhaps that's the cynical way to look at college football.
Sure.
But that I believe is the reality that we are living in. Academics can still be important. To many kids, it still is and will always be. But football, if you're playing at this level, definitely takes on a greater significance. To, I think, deny an option for kids who are very clearly heavily invested in their football future, maybe to go elsewhere and play to pursue that dream, I just think is wrong.
It also takes power away from the NCAA, who's been having to decide on waiver appeals.
Well, see, there it is. And
that's power away, which is nice.
You're speaking to my stick it to the man side.
Yeah. You take power away from a governing body that, if you listen to Kirk Ferentz, the sport has probably grown too large for the NCAA to sort of figure out which rules to and to kind of enforce. And that all rings true to me. You're also strengthening, it probably strengthens G5 teams, because a lot of times a Power 5 player will want to transfer to a G5 school, but may want to play immediately or may only have a year of eligibility left and hasn't graduated and goes to the FCS level to avoid sitting out for a year. So you're strengthening G5. And I understand you could have situations like Derek King. You know, it's not working out for him at Houston, and he's obviously proven himself to be a high-level quarterback. Why not go up a slight level? Although Houston's had a ton of success, play in the ACC, play at Miami. Generally speaking, teams that are very, very successful are not doing so because G5 quarterbacks have gone to a Power 5 team. Generally, it's because Power 5 teams build cultures that really strong quarterbacks want to be a part of, and they develop and, you know, become a really strong quarterback or player there. So maybe the FCS level is hurt a little bit by not getting a G5 or a Power 5 transfer, be it at quarterback or any other position. But I don't think it's going to be as pronounced as the alarmists may think.
All right. Enough on the news front.
Okay.
We got a bunch of really smart, really fun questions here from our college football loving verballers.
Congratulations, Skippy. You've got mail.
You've got mail
on the Solid Verbal.
Let's start here at the very top from Brian. He wants to know, how does Baylor's improved defense adapt to the Dave Aranda system? So Dave Aranda, highly paid defensive coordinator for the LSU Tigers. They win a national championship. Matt Rhule leaves, goes, gets a godfather offer from the Carolina Panthers. Lo and behold, Dave Aranda is your new head football coach in Waco, Dan. Now, Dave Aranda comes from really good defensive stock. He's run a great defensive.
He is defensive stock.
He is defensive stock. He kind of sounds like Batman when he talks, right? He's got that gravelly deep voice.
Yeah.
But defensively.
Yeah.
Defensively, what are you feeling here?
So Phil Snow ran an adaptable 3-3-5. He rotated in a number of players, which is good news for the Bears because I think they lose 9 starters. They lose most of, if not all of, their linebackers. Their secondary is going to look pretty different. But a lot of the guys who are stepping in should be familiar with playing high-level college football and a high-level defense. Dave Aranda's defense succeeded. I saw this from Our Daily Bears, a really cool Baylor community. That Dave Aranda's defenses have succeeded in year one. Utah State, Wisconsin, LSU, they've made jumps. So I imagine Baylor's going to be in a pretty good position. I don't know if it's where they were last year. A lot of upperclassmen, a lot of guys with a ton of experience. The Baylor offense to me under Larry Fedora is probably the bigger question. The line is okay, but pretty new. And they should not be as explosive as they were at times. It was not a crazy explosive offense last year. But it's going to be new look on both sides, and I think there's going to be an adjustment period. The good news for the defense is, I mean, are there a lot of scary experienced quarterbacks in the Big 12? My sources say no.
No, not really.
Yeah. Sam Ehlinger, and we assume Spencer Rattler, whoever starts at Oklahoma, should succeed. But otherwise, across the conference, Spencer Sanders had moments, but he's not where Oklahoma State quarterbacks have been. Kansas State, TCU, West Virginia. There are a lot of questions on offense. So it's a good year, I think, to work in a new defensive scheme for Baylor.
On the topic of Baylor, we have a question here from Adam. He says,
it might not even be Dave Aranda's 3-4, by the way.
Correct.
Ron Roberts is the new coordinator. It might be his defense. We'll see.
Correct. And that's where I'm going next year. So Adam writes in and he says he graduated from Baylor.
Baylor!
In 2001, he was before Matt Rhule. He had never seen a Baylor coach leave under good circumstances. And he knows what the talking points are when a coach gets fired for losing or for some crazy other reason. But his question is, what are the talking points when it doesn't end on bad terms? What are the preseason talking points now for Baylor, given the fact that they had a great season a year ago? Matt Rhule leaves, but they bring in an excitable guy in a Dave Aranda. This is a really good question. I had never really considered this. I would lean on the fact that I think the talking points will center around the fact that, first off, Dave Aranda's first time head coach.
Yep.
But Dave Aranda brings in a, I believe, proven commodity, at least in the offensive side of the ball, in Larry Fedora, who knows how to coach offense. Should hopefully improve their output on the offensive side. Excuse me.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Ron Roberts. Ron Roberts was a mentor for Dave Aranda. He taught him a lot of what he knows. So I would hope that if you like the Dave Aranda defense that you've seen over the years, what you're going to see now out of Ron Roberts, even if there is a new cast on the defensive side of the ball for Baylor, you should expect more of the same.
Yeah.
Moving forward, I think you know what you are getting, or at least we have a really good sense of what we are getting for Baylor for the foreseeable future, just given the coaching staff that Aranda has assembled here.
Yeah, I expect year one, reduced sodium Baylor. That's all.
Reduced sodium Baylor. I like that.
Reduced sodium Baylor. Nathan wants to know.
Yes.
Will Wisconsin win a national title under Paul Christ?
No. Next question.
No, but who cares? Wisconsin's really good and fun at football. They need a game-changing quarterback, and I don't think they've had one since Russell Wilson, and that was not an accident, but that was a happy occurrence to receive somebody as talented as Russell Wilson. The talent isn't necessarily there. There's certainly a tier below recruiting-wise and bringing in blue chips to absolutely compete and win a Big Ten championship over presumably Ohio State and then win two games against teams like Clemson, Georgia, Alabama, Oklahoma, that kind of thing. So no, I think probably not, but I'll never say never. I'll say there's a 1.6% chance.
I am not rooting against their chances, but
no,
I tend to agree with you.
No, so nice class that just came into Madison as well. Jack wants to know, who should Colorado hire? And by the time people listen
boy.
To this, do you want to just react to every potential hire we see happening?
Well, we joked around on the mysterious G-Chat earlier today that they were going to announce Brett Bielema at 6:08 p.m. Eastern time shortly after we hit the stop button, because like all big announcements in college football, it always happens immediately after we hit the stop button on a podcast, doesn't it?
Yeah. You're not a college football podcast unless you complain about the timing of coaching news.
So who are the likely candidates here? Brett Bielema's one, right?
Yeah, Troy Calhoun and Brett Bielema. There was a report from Football Scoop I saw today as we record this Wednesday, the 19th?
Yeah.
That an announcement could come as early as tomorrow. So shift time with us. Boo-da-doo, boo-da-doo, boo-da-doo. I think both of those hires, what's the opposite of hot and bothered? Cold and comfortable.
Yeah, I don't like either of those options. Do you?
I like the literal option that Troy Calhoun and what that offense looks like at its best. But I would just go get Ken Niumatalolo and gauge his interest. Maybe he wasn't interested in Colorado, but I would go for the dude.
It's you and this option thing, man. I can't get into it.
Colorado is a job that if you take Colorado to 9 wins. You're probably going to leave unless you went there or are a West Coast guy and that's where you want to coach in the Pac-12. If Brett Bielema goes to Boulder and goes 9-3, he's just going to leave. And we're back here.
Who wants Brett Bielema, though?
I mean, he had a nice year at Arkansas. Singular.
Singular. One.
And a really nice run at Wisconsin. Now he's been in the NFL. Arkansas is a tough place to win, and he had a singular good year. Troy Calhoun doesn't really do it for me. It's hard to know exactly what he'll run. Kenny Omotalolo talked about adjusting his offense when he was under consideration for the Arizona job. And, you know, perhaps it's a different style offense than what he's done in previous years. But the Air Force defenses these past, basically his entire era have not been good. And I understand it's tough to build a good defense when that's what your offense runs, but that's tough. I would trust Ken Niumatalolo more. That's all. That to me is better. I know Eric Bieniemy's name came around. He was the offensive coordinator there, 2011, 2012.
Yeah, recently.
All-time bad Colorado offenses. I don't think that's on him. Has succeeded with the Chiefs. I think he can do better than Colorado. And again, we love Boulder and we like Colorado football being good.
I'm mixed on the Brett Bielema thing. I don't think that culturally he is a good fit, but I am interested stylistically in what a version of his old offense could do in the Pac-12.
Yeah.
If he could rebuild essentially what he had at Wisconsin with a beast offensive line and a really solid running game and just like a really good game manager at quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
You could go places you could win 9 games in the Pac-12 with that pretty easily.
Maybe it's because he was at Colorado State, but Jim McElwain just looks like a Colorado coach. He just looks that dude runs out with the Buffalo. I get it.
Did I see that they were considering Jim Mora?
Of course.
Oh,
any West Coast job, Jim Mora's name comes up. Great agent.
What is it with these retreads? Good Lord. Okay.
I mean, Darren Shivarini, who's been there for a few years.
The assistant,
now,
right?
I know he's been under consideration. Yeah. It's another tough job. Next question.
Next question, Dan. Let's go to Left Coast Kane.
Oh, I'm ready.
Did the Miami Hurricanes win the offseason? Okay,
wow.
This is a loaded question. Headed into spring ball. They went 6-7. They landed a new offensive coordinator in Rhett Lashley, the top two players in the transfer portal. They hired Ed Reed. They finished with the number 13 recruiting class and 6 Under Armour All-Americans. Wow. So I was under the impression that they sort of won the offseason last year when they got Manny Diaz. We did a whole thing on how he's bringing the swagger back to Miami. That did not work out according to the plan here, but now we're back. We're another bite at the apple, Dan. Yeah. Did they win this offseason?
I mean, I've long said Miami and USC are sister schools. And USC, man, those recruiting classes, the assistant hires, the transfers,
is Rhett Lashley good?
Yeah, that's a question.
Is he actually good?
His offenses, whether or not he's called the plays, I don't know if he's been like the architect, because it's been with Gus Malzahn and most recently Sonny Dykes at SMU. His offenses have succeeded with other people building those offenses. And so Auburn's offense seemed to get worse the more he was empowered. I wasn't in the room. I have no idea. But that's what it seems. That, you know, the Nick Marshall offenses were really fun. And then when they went into the post-Nick Marshall world, where Rhett Lashley seemed to have more responsibility, they weren't as good. So I don't know. I honestly don't know about that. And the transfer portal thing, Derek King, certainly promising. Quincy Roche, I think his name is, from Temple, the edge rusher, really strong for Temple. Ed Reed, if he can play safety, if he's able to play. I don't know exactly. I think he's, the head of personnel, chief of staff, something like that.
Sure.
So hopefully that's a good influence on people caring at Miami. It's just, what does the offense look like? That's all it is. And so winning the offseason, I don't know. I like what Oregon's done personally, hiring Joe Moorhead, recruiting well, keeping Mario Cristobal. All of those things have been positive for me. There's a number of teams who have had decent enough off seasons. Tennessee finishing with a really nice recruiting class and finishing their year. I think the momentum is nice for Tennessee. Sure. I think winning the offseason is an important thing if you're Miami. So yes, I will say yes.
Sure. I mean, I like the fact that Manny Diaz is pulling out the stops here and seemingly trying to build a better program, trying to make an immediate impact. But
I would hope so.
Yeah, I mean, there's reason for optimism, but I was very optimistic going into this last season, and that did not work out at all.
Yeah. Derek King behind that same offensive line won't be amazing.
Dakota writes in, when will be the next time? So get out your crystal ball here, Dan.
Yeah.
The next time a team west of the Mississippi wins a national title, and who will it be? Wow.
I'm going to try to translate this. When will a team west of the Mississippi win a national title?
Yes.
How we would edit that, and who is going to be that team? I think the easiest answers would be, and I had to look up exactly the border of the Mississippi.
I did too, River. Actually.
So if you are back and forth about Minnesota, they count. Minneapolis is west,
yes.
I believe, if my research is correct.
Yes.
So Iowa, if that's a team that you're considering. Nebraska? Who will it be? I think the earliest is probably 2021 would be the earliest. And I would have it as probably Oregon, Washington, Oklahoma. And I would say Oregon or Washington because I think the paths are easier for them if the Pac-12 remains somewhat down at the top.
Okay.
We'll see what happens with Washington at quarterback, but I'm pretty confident Washington can build a borderline championship defense with how they recruited.
See, I'm not feeling you on the Washington vibe.
Oh, I love hyping up Washington.
I know. You do it every year. Look, Jimmy Lake could work out. There's a lot of reason to believe that Jimmy Lake will work out. I'm always skeptical on new coaches.
You've watched John Donovan offenses.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Implosive. Sorry.
So forgive me if I'm a little bit skeptical. I share your optimism on Oregon. I've got Oregon in my contenders list as well because recruiting's been strong.
Yeah.
Mario Cristobal has played a much more physical brand, I think, of football, especially on the defensive side of the football.
Bringing that SEC mentality.
Bringing that SEC mentality to the Pacific Northwest. So more to come on that front, to say the least. I like Oregon. I like Oklahoma. Or Oklahoma kind of goes without saying. They've been knocking on the
door. I almost want to disqualify Oklahoma.
Well, they're in here. This is the question.
I've seen them in the playoff. I have not seen the current iteration of Oregon on against, we'll see them against Ohio State early next year. I have not seen them on that stage. So I cannot say with certainty that there is a good chance they're going to get blown out.
Right.
But with Oklahoma, you can.
You can. You can. Yeah. Let me throw Texas A&M out there. A coach that's been there before.
That's such a tough path, though.
It's a very tough path, but it's a coach that's been there before in Jimbo Fisher. It's a recruiting situation that's been very strong the last 2 years, especially this year. Very, very good. He's building depth. He's also got a lot coming back from last season. So it's a good situation in College Station. I don't know how soon it is. And I know Alabama is still recruiting and still playing at a very, very high level. But what the post-Tua Alabama looks like remains somewhat to be seen.
I have a guess. I think they're going to look like Alabama.
They're going to look incredible, I'm sure. Yeah. But there is some turnover there that maybe they can take advantage of. The SEC West is baller. Obviously, LSU just won a national championship, so that's a pretty good situation as well.
But LSU is going to take a minute to get back to where they were, though.
I believe that's accurate. So A&M is interesting to me. The two programs that aren't on either of our lists are Texas and USC.
I would put Texas ahead of Texas A&M. I would put Texas A&M ahead of Texas if they were still in the Big 12. It's a path thing to me. And as open as the SEC West appears to be with a new full-time starting quarterback for Alabama and some consistency issues in retaining assistants, Alabama is still crazy talented. LSU should field still really good sides of the ball. Offense and defense should still be interesting enough. The Mississippi schools are not national title contenders. Auburn is a perennial, dangerous at times team. The path is just more difficult. And I cannot right now, I mean, this year we'll have Kellen Mond. And I just, moving forward, there's nothing that tells me Texas A&M can come over like two humps right now. Whereas with Texas, it looks like it's only one hump.
What if
right now?
What if Nick Saban retires in 2 years?
Sure. We've been saying that since 2013.
He may be indestructible.
Yeah.
But if and when he retires, that could upset the balance of things in the SEC.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a long time for USC. It was a long time before they were really good, and it's been a long time since. So.
All right.
They had the Sam Darnold year, and that was that.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Jeremy says, I know you guys love to do restaurant recommendations, but what about stadium recommendations? What's on your bucket list for college football stadiums to attend? And which ones have you been to that Verballers should go to? So for those listeners who do not know the full story of how this show came to fruition, Dan used to do a digital series for SI.com called the College Football Tour Guy, the SI Tour Guy, as he was later known. You visited a lot of college football stadiums. So your resume, at least in this sense, is far deeper than mine. What are your recommendations here?
Wisconsin, in terms of putting it all together, game environment, tailgating, town, is really strong in the Big Ten. I've enjoyed going to some of the cocktail party. It's not a college town. I would, if you're looking at bucket list stuff, maybe don't go to a neutral site game. In terms of places I haven't been that I'd like to go, I still haven't been to the Plains. So I haven't been to an Auburn game. I haven't been to Stillwater or Norman. I'd like to go to both of those places. I haven't been to, I'm not dying to go to a Florida State or Miami game, but I would. That's just not top of my list where some of other, you know, the smaller college towns are. Clemson's a really good time if it's a big game. They just don't play that many big games with what the ACC is like right now.
Sure.
Unless, I guess, Notre Dame comes to town or if, you know, North Carolina or Louisville continue to improve. What else is on my – Tennessee is wild. I love my time at Tennessee. That is a just enormous undertaking. Oregon and Washington are both fun out west in the Pacific Northwest. It's – you know, even though Seattle's not a college town, that stadium's right on the lake as well. It's a good time. I'm trying to think other bucket lists. Wisconsin, to me, is in the Midwest. Notre Dame's a good time, but South Bend didn't really move the needle for me. But the actual Notre Dame campus and stadium was pretty incredible. So, yeah, I would say in the Midwest, go to Madison would be my verdict. And in the South, LSU or Ole Miss.
LSU or Ole Miss. Okay. I'm going to go with your recommendations. Go with Dan's recommendations.
Georgia's also a great time.
Georgia was a good time. I enjoyed my enjoyed my game that I saw at Georgia.
Yeah.
Which new hire? This is from MSU Jargon.
Great.
Which new hire will win the most games next year and which coaches will be on the hot seat in 2020? So we're just skipping over 2020 here and going right to the end. So here's a quick listing of new coaches. We've got Sam Pittman at Arkansas, Eli Drinkwitz at Mizzou, Mike Leach at Mississippi State, Jeff Hafley, Boston College, Mike Norvell, Florida State, Jimmy Lake at Washington. We mentioned him earlier. Mel Tucker at Michigan State. We've got Lane Kiffin at Ole Miss. We've got Greg Schiano at Rutgers, Ryan Silverfield, Memphis, Jeff Scott, USF, Dave Aranda, Baylor, Kalen DeBoer at Fresno State. We've got Brady Hoke at San Diego State. And did I mention Todd Graham?
Todd Graham, yeah. I mean, there are more than this, but these are the ones I guess we'll consider. Yeah.
Okay. So of these here, who strikes you as being in the best situation to, let's say, win the most games and or potentially make a big bowl game?
So there's only a couple of them where the coaches left because situation was good and they decided to retire or move on to a bigger job. And so it's Ryan Silverfield at Memphis, Jimmy Lake at Washington, Nick Rolovich at Washington State.
I forgot to mention Nick Rolovich at Washington.
Nick Rolovich, Washington State, yes. Right. Obviously, Jeff Tedford retired for health reasons from Fresno State. San Diego State has been in a good situation, especially on defense. And Baylor and bringing in Dave Aranda to replace your guy, Matt Rhule, heading to the Carolina Panthers. So a lot of like continuity schools. I'm probably going to say Ryan Silverfield at Memphis.
I've got him highlighted.
Returning quarterback, non-major conference, but semi-major conference, depending on where your brain's at. I think he's in a good situation continuity-wise, whereas a lot of these guys are either in very tough divisions, tough conferences, or are inheriting a talent level that's probably year two, 3 years away. So I'm going to go with Ryan Silverfield here.
I agree. Moving on.
All right. Next.
Taylor says, tell me something good about Texas Tech football.
Oh, Alan Bowman's good.
Alan Bowman's good. They've also got a terrific home schedule.
They have a good schedule.
Next year, they've got Baylor, Texas, and Oklahoma all at home.
Their defense was probably their best defense. I know the Big 12 was very different in 2019, but probably their best defense since like 2013.
Yeah.
Something like that.
That's fair to say.
Points per drive was like 77th, which is a revelation to just being kind of below average. So it's going to be an interesting year. Alan Bowman seems to always get hurt. So sometimes quarterbacks get hurt a lot and then they just don't. And hopefully that's what happens with Texas Tech.
He also says actual questions. So apparently that wasn't his real question.
Oh, okay.
How does the Pac-12's continued descent impact the overall landscape of college football? If it doesn't improve in the next few years, how does realignment look for West Coast football? So does he mean realignment in a figurative or a literal sense? Because I am here for the literal sense. If we
what, you mean like that, like Pangea?
Oh, let's do that Pangea again? Thing again.
Land masses rejiggering.
Oh, let's get Chip Brown on line one. Let's do this whole thing over again.
Yeah, the West Coast literally breaking off the rest of the country and floated to the Pacific.
Right, right.
It makes it worse. I mean, the Pac-12 playing interesting games on a channel that everybody gets is a net positive for everybody involved. I don't know if and when that happens. So I think he's probably asking, like, does the Pac-12 and Big 12, do they merge? That seems to be the underlying part of his question. I don't think so, but I can't swear that it won't happen. It is... important for every single major conference to have impressive teams at the top and good enough teams in the middle that any given week something weird can happen. Sort of like where the Big 12, I think more often than not, has been. Maybe what the SEC looked like in 2014, 2015 when Ole Miss became a player. What the ACC was like with, you know, the annual Clemson, Florida State, but also, you know, Louisville's hanging around, Teddy Bridgewater, all these teams. That's what you want. And that's where the Pac-12 isn't. The Pac-12 has chunks of impressive teams at different places. You know, ASU here and there, USC's offense, Utah until they have to play talented teams, Oregon when they're not let down against a team like ASU or finishing the Auburn game in that way. They need that quality at the top. They need two really strong teams at the top and then four teams after that that it have their act together. You know, get that 3 out of 3 on the competence test that we did on the twos cruise midway through the year. And I am not confident in it. I really am not. So I think college football is just going to continue to suffer without a decent Pac-12.
So we just move Arizona and Arizona State along with Colorado and Utah over into the Big 12. I guess they'd have 14 teams at that point.
So now you have the back to the Pac-8?
I think so. Yeah, that would be 8.
Yeah, that's really a solution, is to take out teams and fan bases.
Oh, I am here for this.
Maybe one of the best two college basketball teams in the conference in Arizona or programs. Yeah, that's a very strange, all but right. Okay. Maybe the only consistently good team football-wise in Utah.
Jake says, what traditionally bad program would you want to suddenly become a national power?
Yeah.
The example he uses here is UCLA. He says UCLA is now the best team in the Pac-12 and a consistent top 10 team. So he says traditionally bad program.
I guess Notre Dame.
Yeah. Which is kind of misleading. Like, is UCLA traditionally bad? I don't know if I go that far.
So if we were to shift this to like underperforming. Yeah. Given what we consider to be a higher ceiling than what they've shown.
I actually did take this in a more literal sense, traditionally bad. So I went through each Power Five conference and identified the schools that I would want to root for to suddenly become that national power. In the ACC, for me, it's Syracuse. Syracuse has
really
been traditionally pretty bad. Yeah.
Okay.
And I've always been a fan of Otto the Orangeman.
Yeah, Otto the Orange.
So for me, it's Syracuse. Also, the Carrier Dome, just a weird place to play.
I do enjoy that element.
More notoriety for the Carrier Dome in Syracuse and the Orange is pretty exciting. Iowa State in the Big 12. Now, maybe not so much recently, but Iowa State's been a doormat for a long time in the Big 12. And I've enjoyed what's going on there under Matt Campbell. And I'd love to see more of it. So Iowa State. Easy
National power me. Iowa State is an easy answer, just because those games, when the big games in Ames, are always fun.
In the Big Ten, Minnesota is really interesting to me. Minnesota had a renaissance this past year, and PJ Fleck is trying to build them up accordingly. But they play in an outdoor stadium in the middle of winter. It's maybe not the easiest place to recruit to, but it definitely poses an interesting challenge if you're a team having to go to Minneapolis in mid to late November.
I'd rather have Nebraska as a super strong team than Minnesota.
But they're not traditionally bad. Maybe underperforming.
I'm saying underwhelming. Modern underwhelming.
Modern underwhelming. Okay. I could get behind that too. But
Minnesota is currently peaking, and he used the example of top 10 UCLA, and you are pointing out Minnesota, who literally just finished the season.
I know, but 10. Traditionally they've been very bad.
I know. I don't think, no, Minnesota has not been traditionally very bad. They've not been an average program. Oh, come on. They're a perennial bowl program.
Are they?
Yeah.
Look that one up.
Okay, I'll look it
up. If I'm wrong, yell at me. I'll take it.
Okay. Okay, right. Pac-12.
Pac-12, I've got Cal.
I think I'd rather have UCLA. They play in the Rose Bowl. They've had big names come through there. Chip Kelly's there now, so that means Chip Kelly's reigniting the program, which I think is a positive thing.
What about Arizona?
Arizona's fine. They're fine. I think UCLA is just a better answer.
You know, it might be a better answer, but the one thing that I find interesting about you.
Since 1999, Minnesota has 4 seasons where they haven't been to a bowl game.
Really?
So since 1999, if I'm going to add on the fly, 7, 9, 14, 16 out of 21 seasons, they've been to a bowl game.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know that. I'm going to leave this in the show.
That was after a long gap.
Well, thank you.
The Jim Wacker era, was not super kind.
All right. So there's a little something for everybody. If you want to yell at me at Solid Verbal, you can yell at me. It's fine.
Shout out Joe Salem. Shout out Murray Warmath.
That's
Cal
right.
Stoll. Yeah.
What I was going to say, though, is the one thing that I don't know if it comes through on any of our shows is, of course, you're Mr. Pac-12, Mr. Oregon.
Yeah.
People know that, but I don't think it ever truly comes through just how angry you are that Arizona isn't better.
I do want Arizona. Arizona's a great time. What were we just discussing this with? Sumlin disappointing?
We were just talking about this very point. And
yeah, Arizona not being a bowl team is the dumbest thing in the world.
It comes through like fire on the Mysterious G Chat when we talk about Arizona. And you are genuinely, like, viscerally angry over the fact that this is not a better football program.
I mean, I'm a legacy. My mom went to Arizona.
Yeah, right.
Proud graduate. I think UCLA is the better answer there. Colorado, I think, they're not print. They've won a national championship, but it'd be better if Colorado were better. I'd want probably, and they appear maybe to be on an upswing. I'd love for Tennessee to be a power again.
Yeah.
And add some depth to the East there. I'd love for Arkansas to be mixing it up once again. I mean, those like the Run DMC teams.
Yeah.
Amazing. Amazingly fun to have Arkansas in the mix at the top of the sport.
I'm okay with both those. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Where do you want to go next here?
Let's go to Mike. Any tips for being a new dad and watching college football? Now, this is sort of, we're doing a non-college football and a not like a non-college football part two to this Q&A.
Yes.
But this is a college football specific watch question. So I'm going to do my best to tie it specific to watching college football. He and his wife are expecting their first in August. So I'm trying to strategize the fall and the college football intake now.
So I'm going to sit this one out.
No, Ty, I think you should jump in.
I could. I mean, I'm a.
You have so many good answers when you talk about things that you're not personally experienced with. And so do I.
I have a puppy, which isn't quite the same thing.
What?
So if you want feedback on that side of things, Mike, I'd be happy to oblige. But no.
Have you ever in person, when somebody's talking about their kids, say, listen, I don't have a kid, but I have a puppy. I have a puppy. So if I can jump in right here.
No. I haven't and I won't.
Drop your kid off at obedience school while you're at work.
That's right.
And they'll give you a certificate.
All right.
They
so what's the beg. What's the strategy here?
The strategy is to get your kid probably sleep training. I have a couple recommendations as early as they'll let you, so you get on a good schedule.
You were trying to get me to buy this from my cousin who just recently had a baby.
I've got a really good recommendation, but I think I'm going to try to get them on board as a sponsor.
We
got to
get them as a sponsor first.
Because it will be the best reads I've done since I told the world how much you love Manscaped.
That's right. Great.
You got to get them on a regular sleeping schedule. And then what you have to do is to your spouse say, what do you want to get done? Do you have errands? Do you want to take a nap? Do you want to go for a run? Do you want to visit, hang out with your friends? You let me know what you want to do because I want to go to the gym and I want to schedule that around the sleep schedule. And then you go to the gym for the last hour of a game you really want to watch and make sure you go to a gym that has TVs. Because I would also recommend your instinct is going to be, I need to sleep when the baby sleeps. And that's right. But also, sometimes instead of taking a nap, you should go work out because that's very good for your brain and your body. So I would time up gym visits with a TV or just like bring a tablet that you can stream games on and just go real slow on the treadmill, real slow on an exercise bike, and find that window of football watching you want to watch, or just DVR games and do the best job you can without finding out the results. And you're going to be up in the middle of the night anyway, probably either with your wife or solo, if that's how you're feeding, and, you know, zoom through games at, you know, 2:44 a.m.
Window of opportunity, I think is what I'm hearing here. Okay.
But do some time management negotiation and be the one to say, what do you want to get done? I will watch the kid and then time it up so your gym visit coincides with the last hour.
I got you. That's all right. Well, good luck to you, Mike. Congratulations.
Be giving.
Let's do like two or three more here.
Yes.
And call it a night. Austin Tejas says, what do y'all think? Did I do the y'all right?
I mean, you've long done y'all, so yes, that was an improvement.
What do y'all think the ideal conference size/structure should be?
Yeah. Bill Connolly's pods, obviously.
Obviously.
Get pods going so teams play each other more often than not. Because what do we have this week? We had Texas A&M and Georgia playing for the first time since joining the same conference.
That's right.
Yeah. So I'd avoid situations like that with pods to schedule regularly occurring matchups. I like 12.
I like 9 conference games. And the extra flavor that I would add to this, and I don't know how you could possibly enforce this, but I got 12 teams, 9 conference games, and one honest to goodness try at a premium non-con opponent.
I don't even need 9. I'm okay with 8 if everybody across the board is playing 10 Power 5 games or something like that. In the way that we have these, you know, Clemson, South Carolina, Florida, Florida State, we have these interconference annual matchups. If we get those, I'm fine with an 8-game pod system.
Okay. I like the pod system. I just don't think it's realistic.
Look up Bill Connolly's pod system, and I think you will all be converts.
Because we can't do a Q&A show without a Jim Harbaugh question. This one from Abbott says...
Dear friend Abbott,
he says, not that I think there's a better option, but how many straight losses to Ohio State will higher-ups at Michigan take before showing Harbaugh the door? Abbott. Listen, quote, not that I think there's a better option, end quote, is doing a lot of work in this question, Dan.
Yeah.
A lot of work here. I think it's far more likely that Jim Harbaugh finds a different gig, most likely in the NFL, than Michigan ever firing him. Agree, disagree.
I don't care that much about Jim Harbaugh's job security. But I think the way he framed this question is right. Not that I think there's a better option. I think if I were to frame this question, it would be, how many times can he lose to Penn State and or Wisconsin and or Iowa, say, before his seat warms up? I don't think Michigan has to consistently beat all of those teams every year before we can, and we've talked about this before Ohio State is the measuring stick for Michigan. I know they're a rival, but they're ahead. They're just ahead as a program.
They are ahead.
And they're ahead by a considerable margin if you look at the recent scores. I know there was the JT Barrett game, but it doesn't look like Ohio State is going to have a quarterback who is similar to JT Barrett or has JT Barrett's consistency limitations anytime soon. So beat those 3 teams. And Michigan State, I mean, we'll see. I mean, Michigan State is not in the position right now, I think, of Iowa, Wisconsin, and Penn State. But Michigan has to jump out of that group before we can say, well, they've lost another one to Ohio State. I think it's just, I think it's framed improperly, even if that's the reality. So
okay.
I think if he loses the next 3 by 3+ touchdowns.
Right.
And it's the game that seals Michigan cements Michigan as a non-double digit, that cements a 9-3 season. I think it warms up. But there has to be an obvious person to ascend to that position. And the odds of that happening are not zero, but it seems sort of like a stretch.
Sort of like a stretch.
Like Jim Harbaugh and having acrimony at San Francisco and having acrimony in Ann Arbor with Brady Hoke, that was obvious. I don't know who that obvious name is. I'll bet you it's not Les Miles.
All right. Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. We did see offensive improvement towards the latter half of the year.
Sure.
So I think at least on the coaching side of the offense, the move to go out and change the system up did yield some results later down the stretch. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that translates to beating Ohio State. I don't know if that translates into getting Michigan to a more stable spot, but I was encouraged by that at the minimum. So
Grizzly Webb asks a fascinating question.
Grizzly Webb, okay.
What can a school do to change the national perception that their school has a very toxic fan base? He adds here, he's a diehard Colgate fan. No.
Wow.
I don't know if you thought about this at all. I thought about it a little bit, and I don't know what a school can do.
I didn't even see this question, to be honest.
Yeah, it came in earlier today, or came in pretty late on the subreddit, solidverbal.reddit.com. Join now. What I think a lot of this is dependent on is maybe the fan communities. Are there funny people, funny fans that are tweeting out funny things or starting blogs or podcasts or video series that they themselves come off as being somebody with a sense of humor, somebody who doesn't take things too seriously, and somebody creating a sort of fan universe that you want to be a part of because it doesn't seem full of hate and toxicity?
So what you're saying is that we have reopened our recruitment.
Yeah.
As a college football entity, the Solid Verbal is open to changing its fan affiliation. Can you hire someone like a Matthew McConaughey? Like a Matthew McConaughey. Of course, you can't duplicate.
Well, I don't think Texas was ever thought of as being toxic.
No, but like if you put Matthew McConaughey in or on top of a really toxic situation, do you think that would immediately revive the image of that fan base?
So I was going to actually go to Texas A&M.
Okay.
Not that I thought Texas A&M was toxic, but it definitely appears to be a fan base that can get too serious.
So if you took McConaughey and transplanted him, forgot about his Texas affiliation,
right,
and moved him over to the A&M side of things, do you think
really
that would change?
You're flaming this up.
Well, I'm trying. It's one of our last questions. I got to
No. That's
would
not what
help?
I'm saying. So, for instance, like Tex Aggs does an incredible job covering the Aggies, right? They are just a one-stop solution. They produce a ton of content. I know they're affiliated or were affiliated with The Athletic, whatever it is. And it's just like this grouping of diehards. I remember like Robert Gates was on Tex Aggs, right?
Yeah.
Secretary of Defense. Like you just have. And so like I would always just think about Texas A&M. Like, okay, there's this ag and like military type school, and they don't have the history of top level success, but they expect it. They're so serious. They're on message boards all year long. You have these like crazy important people on there. And then the Good Bull Hunting people popped up, and they do an incredible job, and they have like a sense of humor. And I always am excited to see what they have to say about the Aggies. And they do really fun graphics and stuff like that. And that totally altered my overly serious perception of Texas A&M and their fan base. Because those guys are good at what they do in terms of not going berserk and having a little fun with it. Felt the same way about some Iowa fans that are funny, like Spencer Hall in Florida. Like when you have those prominent fans or communities that do a good job of putting things in perspective and getting a little wacky, that changes things for me. Fair or not.
Okay.
I don't know what you do, because they're the most public facing fans if you're asking about toxic. Because every school has a section of fans that are yelling at recruits online and are poisoning trees and yelling terrible things to children wearing the wrong colors at games. That exists everywhere. Yeah. That's this dumb sport that we love. But yeah, I think you just got to get lucky with some of your public facing fans.
I was just going to say Russian disinformation, Dan, but
that's always
you have a much better thought out answer. So we can go with that.
I'll tell you this. Mike Golic Jr. has done a nice job of younging up Notre Dame.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a very old, angry fan base.
It's not that angry.
You've done okay, too.
I didn't play for Notre Dame.
No, but you also get angry. Surprise.
All right. Final question here from Peter.
All right.
Who has been your favorite player that you discovered by accident? Example, you turn on Team X because you've heard about their star tight end, but discover their running back that no one else is talking about. He's really the one who melts your butter. I love that term, melts your butter.
Mm.
So I have a very easy one for me, and it probably doesn't quite fit the example that he laid out, but for me, it's Clyde Edwards-Helaire.
Oh, good answer.
For LSU.
Good answer. Good answer.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's what they tell you at game shows to do.
Yeah. No, for me, it's Clyde Edwards-Helaire. I had tuned in for Joe Burrow all last season, and I feel like every time I saw Clyde Edwards-Helaire, I came away impressed.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was seeing him with virgin eyes, Dan, for the first time. So Clyde Edwards-Helaire for me, it's an easy answer.
This year he started the season as a backup, but obviously Mikhail Cunningham to me.
Mikhail! Like
Puma Pass, Scott Satterfield's first year. They start running all over Notre Dame and then things kind of go south, but then he's a revelation for Louisville. Didn't originally tune in for him, but there he was. I remember specifically, and maybe I'm misremembering, but when Kansas State was really peaking 7, 8, 9 years ago with Colin Klein, everyone was like, he's the new Tebow.
Mm.
And he would always do that sort of stutter like it's going to be a draw and pop back or do little pop passes and stuff like that. And Kansas State was winning a lot of games. People were going into Manhattan thinking they could come out with a win. Bruce Snyder family, whatever. And they didn't.
No.
And I would watch some of those games for Colin Klein. And I guess the good people at Samsung did too, because he's all over their commercials. But then I saw when he would throw it, every time he threw it to this one dude, he would catch it. And then they just kept throwing it to him and nobody could cover him. And I love that element more than I love Colin Klein. And that was Tyler Lockett.
Okay.
And he just sort of came out of nowhere for me that like just consistently he was dependable. He was unguardable. Those are the guys, the receivers that just continue like, I mean, this year with Minnesota, that did it a little bit for me that I was watching. Okay, let's see if Tanner Morgan gets better. Then, like, they have arguably maybe it's not Ohio State's level, but maybe the best receiving duo in the conference in Tyler Johnson and Rashad Bateman. Those types of surprises happen every year for me. It's happened for teams I root for. It happens for teams I root against. I remember feeling that way about Buda Baker for Washington.
Yeah.
We're just like, damn, this dude's everywhere.
Man, Tyler Lockett's such a good answer. I've had him stashed away on my fantasy football bench for like 5 years waiting for him to pop, and it finally happened like the last 2 years.
Did it? Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Juan. Thank you all for the questions.
Yeah.
Don't forget to go on out to that link I mentioned earlier, solidverbal.com/live. We want you to take our survey. Let us know if you want to come see us in person. We're still trying to figure out where exactly we're going to go in the month of August, but your feedback will most certainly help. So if you can fill that out, that'd be helpful. Don't forget to follow us on all of our social media channels. And by all means, if you got something to say, if you want to talk to us, take a knee, talk a little bit more individually, more personally.
Yeah.
SolidVerbal@gmail.com is always the email address, Dan.
That's
all I got.
I think that's all I have. I was listening to a podcast I really enjoy that I'm sure is much too big for me shouting them out to do anything, but there's a show called Two Bears, One Cave, Ty.
Oh, nice.
A couple comedians, Tom Segura and Bert Kreischer. And on this week's episode, they made a point of overemphasizing Louisville. And it brought me great joy. If you decide to listen to that show, it's for mature audiences. It is not safe to listen to at work out loud. But if you like comedians and like podcasts, they do a great job.
NSFW is the
NSFW. Louisville. Made me very happy. I laughed on a subway platform.
For that guy over there, my good friend Dan Rubenstein, for myself, Ty Hildebrand, thank you so much for tuning into the show. We will catch you all in a week. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your week, all of your weekend. And hey, stay solid.
Peace.